The Good Life. There have been, at different times and among different people, many varying conceptions of the good life. To some extent, the differences were amenable to argument. This was when men differed as to the means to achieve a given end. Some think that prison is a good way of preventing crime. Others hold that education would be better. A difference of this sort can be decided by sufficient evidence. But some differences cannot be tested in this way. Tolstoy condemned all war. Others have held the life of a soldier doing battle for the right to be very noble. Here, there was probably involved a real difference as to ends. Those who praised the soldier usually consider the punishment of sinners a good thing in itself. Tolstoy did not think so. On such a matter, no argument is possible. I cannot therefore prove that my view of the good life is right. I can only state my view and hope that as many as possible will agree. My view is this. The good life is one inspired by love and guided by knowledge. Knowledge and love are both indefinitely extensible. Therefore, however good a life may be, a better life can be imagined. Neither love without knowledge nor knowledge without love can produce a good life. In the Middle Ages, when pestilence appeared in a country, holy men advised the population to assemble in churches and pray for deliverance. The result was that the infection spread with extraordinary rapidity among the crowded masses of supplicants. This was an example of love without knowledge. The late war afforded an example of knowledge without love. In each case, the result was death on a large scale. Although both love and knowledge are necessary, love is, in a sense, more fundamental, since it will lead intelligent people to seek knowledge in order to find out how to benefit those whom they love. But if people are not intelligent, they will be content to believe what they have been told, and may do harm in spite of the most genuine benevolence. Medicine affords perhaps the best example of what I mean. An able physician is more useful to a patient than the most devoted friend, and progress in medical knowledge does more for the health of the community than ill-informed philanthropy. Nevertheless, an element of benevolence is essential even here, if any but the rich are to profit by scientific discoveries. Love is a word which covers a variety of feelings. I have used it purposely, as I wish to include them all. Love as an emotion, which is what I am speaking about, for love on principle does not seem to me genuine, moves between two poles. On one side, pure delight in contemplation. On the other, pure benevolence. Where inanimate objects are concerned, delight alone enters in. We cannot feel benevolence towards a landscape or a sonata. This type of enjoyment is presumably the source of art. It is stronger, as a rule, in very young children than in adults, who are apt to view objects in a utilitarian spirit. It plays a large part in our feelings towards human beings, some of whom have charm and some the reverse, when considered simply as objects of aesthetic contemplation. The opposite pole of love is pure benevolence. Men have sacrificed their lives to helping lepers. In such a case, the love they felt cannot have had any element of aesthetic delight. Parental affection, as a rule, is accompanied by pleasure in the child's appearance, but remains strong when this element is wholly absent. It would seem odd to call a mother's interest in a sick child benevolence, because we are in the habit of using this word to describe a pale emotion, nine parts humbug. But it is difficult to find any other word to describe the desire for another person's welfare. It is a fact that a desire of this sort may reach any degree of strength in the case of parental feeling. In other cases, it is far less intense. Indeed, it would seem likely that all altruistic emotion is a sort of overflow of parental feeling, or sometimes a sublimation of it. For want of a better word, I shall call this emotion benevolence. But I want to make it clear that I am speaking of an emotion, not a principle. and that I do not include in it any feeling of superiority, such as is sometimes associated with the word. The word sympathy expresses part of what I mean, but leaves out the element of activity that I wish to include. Love, at its fullest, is an indissoluble combination of the two elements, delight and well-wishing. The pleasure of a parent in a beautiful and successful child combines both elements. So does sex love, at its best. But in sex love, benevolence will only exist where there is secure possession, since otherwise jealousy will destroy it, while perhaps actually increasing the delight in contemplation. Delight without well-wishing may be cruel. Well-wishing without delight easily tends to become cold and a little superior. A person who wishes to be loved wishes to be the object of a love containing both elements, except in cases of extreme weakness, such as infancy and severe illness. In these cases, benevolence may be all that is desired. Conversely, in cases of extreme strength, admiration is more desired than benevolence. This is the state of mind of potentates and famous beauties. We only desire other people's good wishes in proportion as we feel ourselves in need of help or in danger of harm from them. At least that would seem to be the biological logic of the situation, but it is not quite true to life. We desire affection in order to escape from the feeling of loneliness, in order to be, as we say, understood. This is a matter of sympathy, not merely of benevolence. The person whose affection is satisfactory to us must not merely wish us well, but must know in what our happiness consists. But this belongs to the other element of the good life, namely, knowledge. In a perfect world, every sentient being would be, to every other, the object of the fullest love, compounded of delight, benevolence, and understanding inextricably blended. It does not follow that in this actual world we ought to attempt to have such feelings toward all the sentient beings whom we encounter. There are many in whom we cannot feel delight because they are disgusting. If we were to do violence to our nature by trying to see beauties in them, we should merely blunt our susceptibilities to what we naturally find beautiful. Not to mention human beings, there are fleas and bugs and lice. We should have to be as hard-pressed as the ancient mariner before we could feel delight in contemplating these creatures. Some saints, it is true, have called them pearls of God, but what these men delighted in was the opportunity of displaying their own sanctity. Benevolence is easier to extend widely, but even benevolence has its limits. If a man wished to marry a lady, we should not think the better of him for withdrawing if he found that someone else also wished to marry her. We should regard this as a fair field for competition. Yet his feelings toward a rival cannot be wholly benevolent. I think that in all descriptions of the good life here on earth, we must assume a certain basis of animal vitality and animal instinct. Without this, life becomes tame and uninteresting. Civilization should be something added to this, not substituted for it. The ascetic saint and the detached sage fail in this respect to be complete human beings. A small number of them may enrich a community, but a world composed of them would die of boredom. These considerations lead to a certain emphasis on the element of delight as an ingredient in the best love. Delight, in this actual world, is unavoidably selective and prevents us from having the same feelings toward all mankind. When conflicts arise between delight and benevolence, they must, as a rule, be decided by a compromise, not by a complete surrender of either. Instinct has its rights, and if we do violence to it beyond a point, it takes vengeance in subtle ways. Therefore, in aiming at a good life, the limits of human possibility must be borne in mind. Here again, however, we are brought back to the necessity of knowledge. When I speak of knowledge as an ingredient of the good life, I am not thinking of ethical knowledge, but of scientific knowledge, and knowledge of particular facts. I do not think there is, strictly speaking, such a thing as ethical knowledge. If we desire to achieve some end, knowledge may show us the means, and this knowledge may loosely pass as ethical, but I do not believe that we can decide what sort of conduct is right or wrong except by reference to its probable consequences. Given an end to be achieved, it is a question for science to discover how to achieve it. All moral rules must be tested by examining whether they tend to realize ends that we desire. I say ends that we desire, not ends that we ought to desire. What we ought to desire is merely what someone else wishes us to desire. Usually it is what the authorities wish us to desire, parents, schoolmasters, policemen, and judges. If you say to me, "You ought to do so-and-so," the motive power of your remark lies in my desire for your approval, together possibly with rewards or punishments attached to your approval or disapproval. Since all behaviour springs from desire, it is clear that ethical notions can have no importance except as they influence desire. They do this through the desire for approval and the fear of disapproval. These are powerful social forces, and we shall naturally endeavour to win them to our side if we wish to realise any social purpose. When I say that the morality of conduct is to be judged by its probable consequences, I mean that I desire to see approval given to behaviour likely to realise social purposes which we desire, and disapproval to opposite behaviour. At present, this is not done. There are certain traditional rules according to which approval and disapproval are meted out quite regardless of consequences, but this is a topic with which we shall deal in the next section. The superfluity of theoretical ethics is obvious in simple cases. Suppose, for instance, your child is ill. Love makes you wish to cure it, and science tells you how to do so. There is not an intermediate stage of ethical theory where it is demonstrated that your child had better be cured. Your act springs directly from desire for an end, together with knowledge of means. This is equally true of all acts, whether good or bad. The ends differ, and the knowledge is more adequate in some cases than in others, but there is no conceivable way of making people do things they do not wish to do. What is possible is to alter their desires by a system of rewards and penalties, among which social approval and disapproval are not the least potent. The question for the legislative moralist is therefore, how shall this system of rewards and punishments be arranged so as to secure the maximum of what is desired by the legislative authority? If I say that the legislative authority has bad desires, I mean merely that its desires conflict with those of some section of the community to which I belong. Outside human desires, there is no moral standard. Thus, what distinguishes ethics from science is not any special kind of knowledge, but merely desire. The knowledge required in ethics is exactly like the knowledge elsewhere. What is peculiar is that certain ends are desired, and that right conduct is what conduces to them. Of course, if the definition of right conduct is to make a wide appeal, the ends must be such as large sections of mankind desire. If I defined right conduct as that which increases my own income, readers would disagree. The whole effectiveness of any ethical argument lies in its scientific part, i.e., in the proof that one kind of conduct rather than some other is a means to an end which is widely desired. I distinguish, however, between ethical argument and ethical education. The latter consists in strengthening certain desires and weakening others. This is quite a different process, which will be separately discussed at a later stage. We can now explain more exactly the purport of the definition of the good life with which this section began. When I said that the good life consists of love guided by knowledge, the desire which prompted me was the desire to live such a life as far as possible, and to see others living it. And the logical content of the statement is that in a community where men live in this way, more desires will be satisfied than in one where there is less love or less knowledge. I do not mean that such a life is virtuous, or that its opposite is sinful, for these are conceptions which seem to me to have no scientific justification.